We're going to spend most of our discussion within the last 30 years or so, but to get us to that point, I am going to read you what I call the first 100 years of Idaho politics in 75 seconds. Ready? Idaho's first decade of statehood resembled a Wild West multi-party shootout where no one had a clear majority. In the early 20th century, the pattern that would become the norm was established, Republicans on top, and Democrats giving them a good run for their money. Democrats gained the upper hand occasionally. They dominated during the Depression. In 1959 and 60, Democrats controlled the state House and Senate. They haven't controlled either since, but they've remained competitive. In fact, Idahoans earned a reputation for splitting tickets, voting for Republicans and Democrats on the same ballot. In the 70s, things got tougher for Idaho Democrats. They lost one of their key allies. Members of the LDS Church left in droves after the National Party embraced a host of liberal social issues like feminism and abortion rights. Mormons have never returned to the Democratic fold in big numbers. Unions were also essential for Idaho Democrats to win. For much of the state's history, those were powerful thanks to the mining and timber industry. By the 80s, those industries were on the decline, and so was union influence. Idahoans continued to split tickets, though, and Democrats hung on to the governor's office and other important elected positions. But for most of the decade of big hair, the momentum was Republican. And that brings us to where I want to hand it off. Dr. Weatherby, would you take the story from here? What was happening in Idaho politics at the tail end of the 80s?
At the tail end of the 80s, maybe just step back 1 minute in terms of this Republican state and the concern about who was the successful first presidential candidate. That was James B. Weaver, a populist candidate. So Idaho's history is very interesting in that regard. Okay, the late 1980s, well, the Democrats were hurt by that 90 election. Senator Frank Church is defeated, and with it goes the church organization, which was a very important part in providing for that successful run.
Sorry, Cecil, Dr. Weatherby, I think you misspoke on the date. Yeah.
Did I say 80?
You said 90,
but it's 80.
At 80, yes. Thank you. It's good that you're here to correct me. This old man here. In 1980, and that's when Senator Church was defeated for re-election, and Cecil Andrus was Secretary of the Interior. There was no real Democratic organization, and the Democrats were in trouble throughout this whole decade, right? No. In 1982, who is re-elected governor? The one governor that often is not discussed in any great detail is John Evans, who served for 10 years, and he defeated in 1982 Phil Batt, the lieutenant governor. In 1984, the Democrats lost more seats than the Idaho legislature, and for the first time since, I believe, 1952, the legislature had a veto-proof majority. So that the big red veto stamp that John Evans wielded for a number of years, and he's the one that had it, no longer was effective. So in 1985, the legislature passed the right to work measure. He vetoed it, his veto was overridden, and in 1986, the Idaho voters, in one of the few referendum votes, upheld the legislature's passage of right to work. Again, that hurt the base of the Democratic Party. Unions were very important. They lost influence and power due to a change in the economy, but also with the passage of the right to work measure in 1985, upheld in 1986. But things were starting to work, and Betty, you came on the scene in the late 1980s in terms of organization and activities that were going on in Boise and Ada County. So I would defer to Betty in terms of the kind of organizational work that was done that led to the Democrats taking half of the state Senate and 39% of the total seats in the legislature in the 1990 election.
That 1990 election was good. The 88 election was also good for Democrats before that. In both of those elections, they gained ground. Things seem to have turned around. Betty, what was the mood for Idaho Democrats during that period, 1988-1990?
Frankly, the Democrats saw something of a perfect storm. We had Republicans in the state legislature who had gone fairly far to the right, to the fringe, and we actively recruited Democrats who could appeal to both the Democratic base, but also moderates, independents, and some of the more, I like to say, rational Republicans. The ones who felt that it was okay to talk to people across the aisle. So, for instance, in 1988, while Idaho voted overwhelmingly for George Bush the First, it also elected Mike Burkett handily in what was then a flotarial district in Ada County.
And who did he defeat?
Jim Risch. And I thought, Jim, I was showing great restraint by not saying that, however.
You planted that, I know.
Yeah. but my point is that I think that in order for Democrats to do well, you do need to have a few factors in play. You need to have a weak Republican incumbent. You need to have a strong Democratic challenger. You need to have adequate funding. And you need to have an issue or two around which they can galvanize the electorate. And we had that in 1988 and 1990. 1990, you will recall that a pro-life governor, Cecil Andrus, ended up vetoing a bill passed by the legislature that was fairly draconian on the issue of abortion, and that he felt, even as a pro-life individual, he could not countenance. That had a lot to do with that 1990 election.
What was the mood, though? What were you thinking and feeling at that time?
That people thought that one-party government was seriously out of balance, and they were prepared to, a lot of Democrats had become discouraged, had sort of fallen away. A lot of them came back and got energized.
Secretary Assersa, how were Republicans reacting to that 88 and 90 election?
Well, we remember we had the infamous Heller versus Santa Rosa redistricting, and we had the 42 senators. But 1990, I remember I called it the witching hour. We had the last day of filing, which is always an interesting scenario at our office. We also had signee die, and we also had the announcement that Governor Andrus was going to veto the abortion bill, all in the same day, and it was like 5 o'clock, all this was happening, and it was quite a scenario, and then what the fallout from that, the abortion bill and Governor Andrus. Republican, and being a Republican over the years and through the 90s and whatever, I think Jim hit on it mentioning 80. As we all know, the Democrat Party, and one of the reasons, and I might as well say it now, why it has not been dominant, is you relied on Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig. You had two superstars in Senator Church and Cecil Andrus, and there wasn't much of a bench. No offense to anyone here.
I think we'd agree with you.
And I think everybody has said that you had these two icons, and the icon was taken. One of them was taken out in 1980 in the Church-Sims race, and then the very tight relationship. And Jim brought it up. And I don't think you can, the way this pendulum has swung. I was 9 years old, but I remember seeing stickers in 1958, vote yes, vote no, the right to work initiative barely hung on there, or barely was defeated. And then the right to work referendum in 1986. The power of the Democrat Party was certainly diminished greatly by the metal industry went down, the timber, the mines, whatever, and the unions. And I don't think it's any surprise that the Republicans have risen since the mid-80s, since the right to work law and whatever. And what was the mood? Republicans were ready to take over and do a great thing. They had some formidable opposition in Governor Andrus. Senator Church was And he's just he was gone, but Governor Andrus was still there. And without him, I think it would have been Republicans would have been more dominant much quicker than we end up being dominant there. And I think the Democrat, you know, you can talk about the lunch bucket crowd versus the wine and cheese crowd that took over in some counties and whatever. You've heard it all. Betty's heard this a million times.
You guys did a great job of driving some wedges there.
Oh, yeah. But, yeah. But, and we had some good folks appear, obviously. I think our bench maybe didn't have the two giant icons, but there were some pretty good hitters there. And kept building it up. And just as an observation that I've seen over the years, I've been on the first working with Pete and then myself, being on Lincoln Days and whatever, I think the Democrats have a very nice big Jefferson Jackson Day banquet here in Boise and whatever draws quite a bit of people. Republicans do about 30, not that big as the Jefferson Jackson necessarily, but we're out there doing 30 banquets, Lincoln Day banquets. And it's the kind of working from the grassroots up and the precincts up that the Republicans have had for many, many years that the Democrats are lacking in. And when you lose your superstars or time or whatever, term limits we don't have, that's an interesting question too. But that's what I've seen happening. The mood of the Republicans became more positive. I think the economy, the fall down of the unions, and of course the fact that the Democrats' bench was very, compared to their superstars, was very weak. And as you get in there, and you know, Betty can talk about she's on a campaign now against an entrenched Republican incumbent who's going to have plenty of money and whatever. It's a tough road to hoe in the state of Idaho. With a D behind your name, unless you're some superstar. And right now, I don't see him.
I want to talk a little bit more about why Democrats saw this uptick in 88 and 90. Betty, you gave us three reasons. Would you repeat those for us?
Well, you had some very weak incumbent Republicans who had staked out some pretty extreme positions. You had some very credible Democrats who worked very hard. And we were able to, frankly, attract the resources and the broad base of support that enabled us to defeat some entrenched incumbents. And, you know, one thing I would say, too, is that the architect of the Republican building that Ben refers to from the precincts on up really, I think, is Phil Batt. And he was a very strong Republican chair. He was ultimately the beneficiary of the own party building that he did. I think that Phil Batt would have a hard time being nominated by his party today. I think it is a party he doesn't quite recognize philosophically. But he really was the one who, after that 82 loss to John Evans, went about the state and rebuilt the Republican Party from the ground up.
Let's talk about what the Republicans did after that 90 election. Dr. Weatherby, you want to talk about the Republican reaction, and then we'll go to Secretary Assersa for that?
Well, I'll follow up Betty's comment, which is right on. The contribution of Phil Batt after that disastrous election for the Republicans, not only losing legislative seats, but the Democrats had a majority on the state land board. They had both congressional seats. That's hard to believe these days. There's probably too much blame put on the most restrictive anti-abortion measure in the country passing and Andrus vetoing it. But I think that was something that stuck with Phil Batt as he rebuilt the Republican Party. And he talked about it not only as party chair, but later when he became governor in his one term when the Republicans regained their majorities, he was always concerned about the party again overreaching and felt that 1990 was a case study of that and that people reacted. And I suspect that was the case, particularly in Ada County and some of these urban districts where Republicans were defeated on a large measure on that anti-abortion bill. But Batt built up the party and also counseled the Republicans that in one way, this is a Republican state, and it can be again, but he also recognized that people's attachment to party is somewhat tenuous, and he always counseled Republicans about not going too far, and his advice was taken then, I suspect, in many areas the Republican Party today is not.
Secretary Ersa, what was happening from your inside vantage point in the party?
After the 90 election and the Senate, and I think Jim certainly would concur in his comments, I think he's been very accurate in the portrayal there, and the 21-21 tie we had and whatever, I was around, the abortion issue certainly in the Treasure Valley cemented that. The Republican platform also did. There was actually changes. You won't see it in there now, but there were changes to the platform that Phil Batt. What Phil Batt did, and I was involved. Well, I was involved with Pete and others, but I was involved on. He went around the state and had meetings with folks about trying to. And this sounds like heresy now, and the lockstep partisan gridlock that we have. But he was saying, we need to be the party of the big tent. You need to be inclusive. Ronald Reagan's quote, you know, if you're my friend 80% of the time, I mean, if you're with me 80% of the time, you're my friend. You're not my 20% traitor. And we've actually tried to say that, but the vitriol that's out there now within the Republican Party is, but what Governor Batt did is to actually get a little bit of a platform and that would recognize some of the not totally pro-choice, but the fact there were people who had other points of view, and as long as, you know, that you would accommodate that. Again, the big tent. Now we're into a phone booth and a pup tent, I think. So he was very much instrumental, and Betty and Jim were right on there to bring him up to get that in there. And then the key, you can talk about the Senate races, the congressional, the legislative. The key point is to get that governor's chair. And and that was the prize that was missing. And once that chair, once the Republicans got that governor's chair, you know, it's been Katie bar the door. It's been hanging on to it and going from there. And the seminal election, obviously, was the Echo Bat election. And
that's an excellent segue. I like that. I was yeah, about to go right there. Dr. Weatherby, would you tell us about the 94 election?
Just one quick follow-up to Ben's comment as well. Democrats benefited from the fact that the gubernatorial elections were held in off-presidential election years, so that the blowout. So John Evans is reelected governor in the 80s, but not in 1980 with a Reagan landslide, but in 1982. And it's interesting that there has been this provision in Idaho that governors don't run on presidential election years. I think it was a Republican idea to begin with because the Democratic presidential candidates did so well earlier in our history. So you see how sometimes things don't work out as you plan. Now you're asking me about 1994?
1994 election.
Sorry, I'm bringing this up, Betty.
That's, I mean, okay,
this is,
Jim.
This is a sad...
History is history.
History,
you know,
for Democrats. You know, and a few of us, quote-unquote, smart people, thought that Idaho politics was changing and Idaho was becoming a more moderate state with all the in-migration of people, and it was explained by the elections of 1988 and 1990. But the Democratic majority started falling off in 92, and then in 94, what happened was could not be foreseen by a lot of people, and particularly the author of the book, The Permanent Republican Minority in the U.S. House of Representatives. That book was published in July of 1994. Obviously, the author of that book did not foresee, along with others, this tide that swept across the country. There was great optimism on the part of the Democrats that Larry Echohawk would be the first Native American governor in United States history. They had, you talk about bench, they had strong candidates for lieutenant governor, attorney general, on down the ticket. They were wiped out in that 1994 race, as well as significant a number of legislative members, and we've moved on from there with declining clout as far as the legislative minority, which has held at about 20% over the last 10, 20 years.
It got down, excuse me, that legislative minority got down to, came in at 96, and it's been right about 20% ever since. Betty, how did Democrats react to those losses in 94 and after?
Well, I think that looking at the reason for the loss in part was that after 1990 you had the census and then you had redistricting. Now we have a citizens commission. But in 1990 you did not have a citizens commission. So you had essentially the legislature redistricting itself. And the legislature was controlled by the Republican Party. So they were able to draw the lines in such a way as to make it more likely that their numbers would increase and the Democrats' numbers would diminish. Once those lines are drawn, they live on for a decade. And it's fairly difficult. So there was a certain amount of institutional inertia once that happened. But, you know, clearly the losses were difficult. But I think a lot of Democrats would tell you that they felt if Larry Echohawk had not run for governor that year, he could have remained attorney general, been reelected, and very possibly lived to fight another day running for another office. I think a lot of Democrats would tell you that had Richard Stallings not run for the U.S. Senate, and at the time he announced he thought he would be opposing Steve Sims, and then Steve Sims did not run, and instead Dirk Kempthorne ran. But that Richard Stallings could have remained in Congress very possibly for a number of years. So as Ben points out, we did lose some superstars, and we did have a fledgling bench, but as is often the case, people are encouraged to try to move up, and perhaps had they not tried in those particular election years, they could have had some more continuity. It's long been my thought that in Idaho, most voters will vote for the Republican they don't particularly like before they will vote for a Democrat they don't know. But once they know a Democrat, once they have a comfort level with a Democrat, a Cecil Andrus, a John Evans, a Larry Echohawk, a Richard Stallings, that the thought is, hey, they're not half bad. And I think that that's our challenge, is to better communicate our message and better introduce our candidates.
Not half bad. What's the percentage of bad? 40%.
Oh, I wouldn't want to guess.
Let's talk about reasons for this Republican rebound of the mid-90s. Jim, you mentioned in-migration, which to me, I think is the most interesting thing that I have read about as I've researched this topic. And it's interesting to me because I remember in the early 90s, bumper stickers that said things like, "Don't Californicate Idaho." You may remember those. Another one, "Welcome to Idaho, now go home." Another one. People
thought
we
stole that from Oregon, I think.
Did you?
Yeah.
Okay. People thought that Californians were going to come into Idaho and make it liberal, ruin it with their West Coast values. But in fact, the opposite happened.
Yes, it did. We thought, as I said before, that this would moderate our politics. It didn't. These people were not coming in from the Bay Area. They were coming in from Orange County and Los Angeles County and San Diego County. And they were part of, quote, the title of that book, The Great Sorting Out or whatever. The people were moving to Idaho primarily for cultural reasons rather than economic reasons. A lot of these were retirees and others who were seeking their own kind. So that rather than moderating our politics, they were reinforcing the conservatism that was there. And the best example of that, of course, is the Panhandle, which once was a stronghold for Democratic candidates. In fact, I can remember two or three Democratic candidates running statewide races that waited till the last minute until the North came in. well, it looks like the North isn't coming in anytime soon again because of the change of that politics, and now it's a delegation of all Republicans, and the question is whether it is, using Lawrence Wasdin's terms, the rational ones or those out on the edge. And we know a few examples of those out on the edge. But this kind of migration supersedes organization. We can talk about what the Democrats haven't done in terms of organization, whether they should be working, recruiting candidates at the top of the ticket or at the grassroots level. But these kind of demographics really hurt them, as well as, and they've been Democrats throughout our history, and we've had a lot of Democrats serving in elective office, but most of those were conservative Democrats. Early in our history, we had a lot of in-migration from the South of Confederate Democrats, now conservative Democrats, who've gone on to become Republicans, who voted in the 60s, up to the 60s with the Democratic Party, but in the 70s with some of the social programs of the Democratic Party you mentioned in your introductory remarks.
In-migration was a big reason for that Republican rebound. Real quick, before we get to questions from our audience, I'd like you each to give me one more reason. Your, after in-migration, your top reason for the Republican rebound of 94, and after that, if somebody else steals yours, come up with another one. Secretary Sirsa, will you start?
I really think you look at it, there were some good points made about the Orange County, the losing the North, things that happened, the unions going down, the right to work scenario there at the same, coupled with the economy going south in our in the mines and the timber and whatever. I think losing North Idaho and the fact that some of the workings of Phil Batt and others to try to get back to the big tent theory, which we need to revisit big time now, but that's another story. I think the loss of their base in the unions, and obviously the loss of some of their icons who were leading the pack, I think led the way. And the fact that the Republicans built a better bench and did a better job at the precinct level all the way up.
Betty?
I would say that another factor, one that hasn't been mentioned yet, is the nationalization of local elections. I think that the influx, whenever you've got a congressional race or a U.S. Senate race or even a gubernatorial race now, if it is looking to be at all competitive, the national media and the national money gets poured in. And so it becomes less a local contest, and it becomes heavily influenced by out-of-state money and out-of-state ideology. And I think that can be very problematic. You know, there was, in 1994, the Republicans had what they called the contract with America. Democrats called it the contract on America. But the fact is that it was a national movement, and it spilled into Idaho. So that would be the additional factor I would mention.
Dr. Weatherby?
A couple of, I would mention, this is one category, three people, Carter, Clinton, Obama. I don't know the numbers on Carter, but I do know that Clinton and Obama probably are or were as unpopular in Idaho as anywhere in the country. A lot of that had to do, I think, with environmental regulations, with their policies toward federal land and the activism that began generating in the 60s and 70s, which I would say as a footnote is really interesting, that Cecil Andrus could come back as Jimmy Carter's unpopular Secretary of Interior and in 1986 be elected again. That was, he had two landslide elections. I'm more impressed by his victory in 1986. Another thing, and I don't have all the answers to it, another major factor in the Democratic Party that has lost influence and has hurt the party, and that is the Idaho Education Association. We talk about 1990. I think if you would do, and some informal surveys were done that the Idaho Education Association in 1990 was probably considered one of the most influential interest groups in the state of Idaho. Not so today because of demonizing public sector unions, perhaps also because of the resources that were expended in the 1990s by the Idaho Education Association against two 1% property tax initiatives, which I'm not neutral on that. I think that would have been a major mistake and would have crippled the budget, and the Idaho Education Association and others were right to fight in those campaigns, but I think it hurt their resources, and their loss of clout, I think, has hurt the Democratic Party in Idaho as well.
Betty, did you want to respond?
Well, and I kind of wanted to augment what Jim just said, because I do think that the Republicans did a very good job of talking about, especially President Clinton, in terms of social issues. And they convinced a lot of people in Idaho that the Democrats of any stripe, of any ilk, we're here to take your guns away. We're here to, you know, do all of these social engineering experiments. And we, as a Democratic Party, I think kind of let them get away with that. And I think that we needed to return to the Andrus formula of the economy, jobs, education, and the environment as part of that. Because the antipathy for the federal government seemed to grow when a Democrat was in the White House. And Governor Andrus had a very nice formulation he always used. He'd say, we want the government, we want the federal government off our backs, but we need it by our sides. And sort of this sense that it didn't have to be this evil landlord. It could actually be a partner and a help to us, and that we could work together. So I think that his formulation was a winning one. Clearly, he has a unique persona, and as Jim says, it's no small feat that he was reelected in 1986. But all that said, he also had a way of talking to the issues in a way that reached out to people who might not ordinarily look at a Democrat.
Could I just a quick follow-up?
Sure.
I absolutely agree with that. When you think of Andrus, you think of education, the environment, and the economy. Those were the three things. You ask what the Democrats stood for in those days, you understood. The question now, what do they stand for today? And sometimes that's not clear. And that's the problem of a quasi, shall we say, minority, or quasi-permanent minority, whatever you want to use, whatever terminology
delete
is.
Delete permanent.
Whether that they go along or they
we'll
stand
that,
up and fight on principles.
All right, we're going to open it up to questions right now. We've got a microphone here in the center. If you're close to that, you can stand up. Frankie Barnhill is coming around with a handheld mic. She's going to hold it. She will slap your hand if you try to take it away from it. She did it at one of our previous forums. And please remember, this is not the place to vent your spleen about party politics in Idaho. I don't want anybody yelling at anybody up here. Please ask your questions, be respectful, and try to be succinct.
My name is Mark Reinhart. I'm from Boise. I have a question here. What has been the role of the independent voter, presumably voting for the individual reflecting a moderate Idahoan's ethical and morals concern? Or historically, if you can give an historical figure, is this idea of Idaho values real or is it a myth?
Who wants to take that?
Well, when you talk about voting and independence and whatever, that there is certainly an independent streak in the Idaho voter, and when it comes time to cast that vote, that's why I was adamantly opposed to our current, the system we have now of a closed primary and party registration and whatever. I figured this crowd might agree with
We're
me on that one.
On that.
I lost, by the way, that case. But and Jim, I think you know some of the statistics. At one time, before we were going to get into party registration, and I can give you the figures currently, what party registration is, and the infamous unaffiliated voter that I wanted to call the independent voter. It used to be like, it would be 20% Democrat and and maybe 35-40% Republican, and the rest were quote-unquote, they would describe themselves as independent and vote for the person. I don't think that's lost. Again, I think you tap it with a certain kind of candidate. Candidates and issues make turnout. Being in the voting business and turnout business, in my 40 years working for the state, I've watched participation decline, 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 and that bothers me. I think we're having a cycle of non-voting built in to our youngsters, and then that continues on. And the quote-unquote independence of the Idaho voter and what they do, do you look at the platform? Unfortunately, I really think it's it used to be in the old days, and now with the third-party attack ads or whatever you want to say, that independent, the personality of a person to capture that independent, I still think the Idaho voters are fiercely independent and will not, don't like to be characterized as one party or the other, and then we'll move. I vote for the person. I vote for the issue. I still think that's there. I think we need a powerful enough personality to grab that.
And don't you think that's reflected in the fact, how many, was it about 33% of registered as Republicans or did in the last election, as opposed to the 40% or more that we know self-identify in public policy right. Surveys. Boise State University yeah. has done surveys, unfortunately not recently due to funding, but over a 20-year period, and never in those 20 years did a majority of Idahoans identify themselves as being Republican. Right. In fact, in the last survey that was done about 3 years ago, a plurality of them, of the respondents, were independents. But I would be very careful about those, characterizing those independents. I'm not telling you these are moderates in between the Democrats and Republicans. Some of them are Ron Paul types, Constitution Party types, farther right than some of even the wildest legislators that you hear quoted from time to time. It's quite a mix of personalities and values. But Phil Batt was right in the 90s, and I think it's still true today, that Idahoans still have a degree of independence. We don't have today, as we had through much of our history, this ticket-splitting preference. To vote in 1968 for liberal Frank Church and George Wallace and have that bumper sticker on our car and see no inconsistency whatsoever.
So are we less likely to split tickets? I think Frankie's coming over to get another question here. We haven't seen that as much as we used to. Is that because the people who moved into the state in the 90s are more loyal to party than old guard Idaho Republicans?
And I think they're responding, as Betty talked about, some of these ideological cues. I think the Idaho voter is significantly more conservative today than it was.
Yeah, I would agree.
Thank you. My name's Frank Gallant. I'm from Boise. Excuse me. I think it was Betty who said the Democrats let them get away with that in terms of demonizing the Democrats and along the lines of several of these major issues. But it seems to me that, again, today there are several major issues facing the state and the country. One is the Affordable Care Act, in which Idaho has had a really high percentage of per capita sign-up. The issue of public lands, and the minimum wage. These are all issues that pertain to us here in Idaho. Are the Democrats again going to let the Republicans demonize them on these issues? Thank you.
Yeah? No. Let me start with the minimum wage. Every candidate for federal office in every Democratic candidate for federal office in Idaho has strongly supported the minimum wage. And I was delighted to see that former Governor Romney has now come in, out in support of the minimum wage. As for the Affordable Care Act, that is an you know, that has some problems. Let's not say that it's the most perfect piece of legislation ever passed, but it's unfortunate when you have a group of Republican members of Congress who decide on a president's first day that no matter what that president does, that they will oppose it, because in doing that, that they will somehow gain the majority and be in the position to elect their presidential candidate 4 years hence. Well, that didn't happen, and it's unfortunate because Affordable Care Act should have been a piece of bipartisan legislation. Most of the ideas in the Affordable Care Act were, in fact, Republican ideas that Mitt Romney came up with in Massachusetts. So, you know, I think that there's a certain amount of setting the record straight. But when you're in an echo chamber and you're in a bubble and all you do is listen to Fox News and Rush Limbaugh, it's going to be a vilifying environment. So I would say, you know, no. Are we going to let them get away with it? No. We will push back. We will try to articulate the differences. And then the third one you mentioned is public lands. And that, I think, could be a huge issue for Democrats. Because one thing that I've heard as I've traveled the state with my candidate is that there is a tremendous desire on the part of Idahoans not to sell off our public lands. There's a deep commitment to the hunting and fishing and hiking and camping, and they understand that the cost to the state, even one catastrophic forest fire, could decimate the state's budget. So I think most Idahoans really have some concerns about this idea that we want to sell off the federal lands. It's gotten great currency in the Idaho legislature, and I was in Washington County not long ago, and I heard a lot of candidates for the legislature speak to that. But I think at the end of the day, we need to work on reasonable, sane, and sound public land management policies, whether it's federal or state. And so to those three issues that you just raised, I don't think you're going to see Democrats being shrinking violets. And I got to tell you, one of the most outspoken individuals has been Richard Stallings. He got on the ballot to run in the 2nd Congressional District, and I don't know if there's something about turning 72, but Richard Stallings is on fire. He is unleashed, unplugged, and he's really becoming a quite eloquent spokesman on those issues. So stay tuned.
One quick follow-up,
just a footnote to Betty's comment. Idaho is unique in that it is the only state where the Republicans control both the governor's office and the legislature that has opted for this state exchange, which I think is commendable. Senator Fulcher has tried to make it a cornerstone of his campaign against Governor Otter, and I'm not sure it's sticking very well in this regard. Would you guess?
I was just going to follow up on that. You got to watch that on the national level versus who I believe is going to get through the gubernatorial race on the Republican side. The healthcare exchange, which is the pivotal point for Mr. Fulcher, and that's about all he's running on.
That and Common Core. Got that too.
The Common Core standard, that's true. And the federal lands issue and that, rest assured that Republicans, let's say rational Republicans, know that's kind of a third rail. And I think it was brought up before a few years ago about selling off lands to fund Katrina problems, and the polls dipped and whatever. So rest assured Republicans know that. And again, you almost have Betty's going to be involved in a federal race, and there's issues there, but the governor's race is going to have a different set of issues on those issues you brought up, Frank, because two of those, I think, the one person I think is going to win the Republican primary on the Obamacare and the federal lands are not as strident as the other ones.
Do we have more questions? I see some over here. Oh, Frankie's got one.
Okay. Hi, my name is Alexander Beringa, and I live in Nampa. I'm glad we've moved beyond 1990 into the present. I'm pleased. Maybe we could also drag in the Tea Party. The other quick question is, I know you're not supposed to talk about religion and politics and things, but we've gotten politics covered, so let's move and ask about religion. what is the effect of religion upon the parties? And I'm not talking LDS either. I'm talking about the wider range of religious influence in parties today. Thank you.
Interesting question. Who wants to take that first?
Nobody.
Next question. No, I will address that. I think that most of the Idaho electorate are people of faith. Now, that can be a very wide range. And I do think that people's faith informs their values and it informs their political choices to a large extent. But I don't think that any faith has a monopoly on any party, or any party has a monopoly on any faith. And I think that increasingly you're seeing, the dominant religions in Idaho, members of the LDS Church and the Catholic Church, who may in the last two decades have tended a little bit more toward the Republican Party, rethinking that alliance. So I think it behooves everybody, and this includes I think being open to people who don't adhere to a religion. There's a lot of people who don't go to church on Sunday. And I think what's important is that we talk about values, and we talk about values in terms of public policy. If it ever becomes a matter that if you adhere to a certain religion, you're going to vote a certain way, then we've effectively become a Middle Eastern country, and I don't see that happening in Idaho.
Frankie's over here.
My name is Charlie Walther. I'm from Boise. First of all, I'd like to thank the panel for their time today. It's been very informative. I think what I have is a question for the Secretary of State, sir. The Republicans pushed through this right-to-work law and basically decimated the unions in the state. Today, Idaho is the lowest earning, let me get this right, the workers of Idaho are the lowest paid in the country. Could you give me your thoughts on that, please?
I thought they weren't going to disparage. No, anyway. What went through my mind, obviously, was the slogan that I think some union folks have used over the years, right to work for less. But unfortunately, that seems to be true of what's going on. There's that issue, and the idea of growing the economy, and have we lost, should we have a minimum wage? You know, obviously, I think the governor and the battle over figures, if there's a Project 60 and whatever, it's really getting bread on the table for Main Street, and I think we could be a lot more robust and build the economy. You're asking me about the effect of the right-to-work law and has it worked, hasn't, you know, we can argue that forever. Bottom line is the more conservative Republican majority in the state has passed it and kept it. It's going to be around. It's unfortunate. I think a good economy helps everybody and shouldn't be a partisan issue and get the wages up. But the facts are the facts. And right now, on that side of the we don't like to talk about it because it's happened during our – I think there was some talk, though, from an economic professor. People get, as usual, the politicians in power at the time get way too much credit if things are going fine, and way too much blame when they're going south, and it's really kind of a product of the economy at the time. I think we're coming out of it, and we'll get better, but I don't see union strength returning in Idaho and membership and whatever, so the right to work for a certain amount is going to be here for a while.
Right to work's been a bit of a puzzler for me. I've wondered how much right to work hurt the unions, or if they were already so weak by the time that it passed that it was not as big a deal as some people think, because they had been on the decline for some time. So was the right to work law in Idaho a death blow for unions, or just a nail in the coffin?
It certainly had a negative effect, but I think you're right to point to other factors. The right to work law passed in 1985, upheld in 1986, In 1981, I believe it was, Bunker Hill closed. Bucyrus Erie, that provided mining manufacturing in Pocatello, closed sometime later. There were things going on in the economy where timber was automating. There were effects that led to the decline in the union membership. Union membership, as I recall, and don't hold me to this, but as I recall, in 1958, when it was upheld and the Democrats won and control of the legislature and the state house, was about 25%, and in the 1980s had declined to 16% or less. So right to work had an effect. I'm sure it did, but changes in the economy had an effect as well.
I would say about right to work, or the so-called right to work, because I do think it's something of a misnomer. But I would say that it's important to remember that capital, and we are a capitalist society, has value. But labor also has value. And the right to collectively bargain requires unions. And yes, there were certainly some problems with extraction industries in terms of union membership and so forth. But the union movement has transitioned in the last several years too. And now you see a little bit more white collar and pink collar and a lot of a broader base. And it's not simply an extraction type of union membership. So I think that, frankly, again, the Republican Party did a fairly good job of talking about capital in terms of captains of industry and in terms of union leaders as thugs. And unfortunately, those labels sometimes stick. You know, I think that we can look at both good labor leaders and bad labor leaders. We can look at good industrialists and bad industrialists. But I think to characterize an entire part of the economy as one or the other is probably inaccurate. Do I think that the unions are going to come back big time soon? No. I wish they would, but I doubt it. But I do think that over time, people will understand that the minimum wage economy we have is a result of the so-called right to work.
We haven't had a question from the middle yet, so let's go to this lady standing up.
Okay, it is on. Okay, Penelope Smith from Nampa. Looking at the history of this period that you're talking about and how the party, both of them, and how the candidates themselves communicate to the voters that they would like to woo, how that's changed, and particularly as so many people are getting their information on small wireless devices.
I'm a Luddite. Go Don't ahead. Ask me.
You're what?
I'm a Luddite.
Oh.
Confirmed.
That's a great issue, or actually a topic to bring up, and how, again, I'm in the voting business and voter turnout business, like I say, and how do you get people to turn out? How do you turn out the certain age group? Jim's group is a little different. 18 to 24 is a little different. Everybody's got their, you got to tweet, Facebook, do all this stuff. So the social media and how that's being used is a completely different dynamic to get the younger crowd, especially. The younger crowd, however, happens to be the lowest voting sector that we have. So the folks who make up the campaign strategy still, they say, that's nice, but we want the ones that are voting to turn out rather than the 18 to 24s, where we struggle to get them to turn out. Obama, 8 years ago or 7 years ago, was able to do that. Last 4 years, that went down. So there's a whole different way of getting to voters. And right here, you know, and I love it. And when I want to put a pitch in, make sure everybody votes, but I'm preaching to the choir here. I'll take a wild guess that you're all going to vote. It's the ones who aren't here that we need to get out to the polls. But there are different ways, you know, media, social media, the influx, you know, we can talk for another topic, money, disclosure, whatever, how that works. But we're trying to look at, we're trying to get a an application, a mobile application, and do things. As soon as you come out with something, you're out of date. So it's something that's tough to get a handle on trying to use the social media. But again, the they'll look at it. And if you have a limited amount of money, you're going to zero in on the people that vote. And the 18 to 24s or whatever, now we're older, I suppose, and we'll use the phone and the Facebook and the tweeting and all that. But it's still kind of Ma and Pa still comes out to vote. And unlike a lot of states have gone big time early voting, as we call it. We call it early voting, early absentee, whatever. Neighboring states, Oregon's totally mail ballot, so's Washington. Montana's over 50%. Our last general election, even though we had a good turnout, whatever, it was still 75% came to the polls. 25% were using absentees. So it's not as high as some other states, so there's still the tradition of going to the poll and casting there. So that's
Betty,
a long-winded discussion.
Do Democrats have a digital strategy?
Oh, yes. And I think you saw that the No on 1, 2, and 3 campaign, that didn't divide completely along party lines, but it kind of did. And, No on 1, 2, and 3 used social media very effectively to its benefit. I would say that one of the challenges Democrats have is breaking through and getting attention from the media. Right now, for almost any newspaper, any radio station, any TV station, the Idaho Republican Party is the only game in town. And good luck to the Democrat who tries to get their attention. It's tough. And when the Republicans have had all of this attention around the primary, the ultimate victor then comes out with a certain amount of name identification. And so the Democrats a little bit behind the eight ball there. And that's understandable. It's a function of the fact that the Republicans have a lot more primaries than we do. But at the same time, I know that it's an issue and a concern to every one of the Democratic candidates who are trying to put forward alternative stands on issues, and it's a tree falling in the forest and no one's there to hear it.
Quick follow-up.
Go ahead.
Adam, and not directly to your point, Betty, but we should mention the defeat of the Students Come First, or popularly known as Luna Laws, went down big time.
Yes.
Was a huge shock. And we still don't know what that is all about. But that was an amazing result with the collective bargaining measure as well as all of them going down across the board in landslide proportions.
We've got time for one more question. Frankie, I'll let you decide who that's going to be.
Hi, I'm Kathy Peter. I live in West Boise. A few states have passed various forms of the top two primary system. And given the I see the Secretary of State smiling over there. Given the number of independents we have in this state and what appears to be a growing cynicism, particularly in younger voters, about organized political parties, do you think there's a future for that in Idaho?
I would hope there is a future for that in Idaho. I mean, we would then go from one extreme to another, and the Secretary and I agree on this in terms, maybe all of us agree on this, right, Betty, that it was a wrong decision to close the Republican primary.
Absolutely wrong
which
decision.
Which is, I'm sorry about the media coverage or whatever, but that is, unfortunately, the de facto election for most candidates. Going to a top two primary, as they've done in Washington and California and some other states, I think opens it up for everybody in terms of making their determination. That might mean, Betty, that it'll be the two Republicans, it'll be the choice at the general election, but maybe it would also mean in District 19 that it would be two top Democrats where some of the Republicans could make a decision about.
And in some instances, it might mean that the top Republican and the top Democrat go at it. But, to answer your question, this isn't something that the Democratic Party has vetted or taken a position on. But I think that it's interesting to look at the other states and see what their experience has been. And I'm not sure that it could be a lot worse than what we've got now.
One quick follow-up on that.
I'm the election guy. Get out of here.
Let's let him have fun.
The parties hate this idea. And it's the Republicans in Idaho want to have a closed primary, and now the Hawaii Democrats want to do exactly the same thing. So it is bipartisan in terms of the parties wanting to control their own nominating process.
Secretary Sessions?
Well, I got to pitch in on a little bit on the top two, and we will never get the top two, in my opinion. Well, it could start. The battle for the precincts in the Republican primary and changing the state central committee, that's the long road to hoe because I'm sure you're aware here, the closed primary came about because of the vote of for a rule in the Republican state central committee to close their primary and because they had enough people to do it. Top two, and because of the Jones case and the constitutionality of the freedom, the right of association. So it was, if the Republican Party said we wanted it closed and we had a law that said you have to have it open, that law was unconstitutional. That's what the case was about. The ones that have been upheld and went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court is the top two system used in the state of Washington. And California put it in, and it's kind of a hybrid of the Louisiana Cajun primary, they call it, the top two. I've seen a top two piece of legislation which from a Democrat, which means it will never go anywhere for a while. It may, if there's enough disgruntlement, you never know if we go through the initiative process. That's a wild card. But for the Republican Party Central Committee is the key that has to change, at least to go to the moderate side. There's a lot of folks that don't like the closed primary, but they don't seem to want, they're not the ones in control right now. And there is a fight going on that will come to fruition May 20th at the precinct level of what the composition of that central committee is. You may see a little, I'm hopeful, but the eternal optimist in me, I don't see it for a while. But the battle was started. They hear too much about the people just don't like declaring. We didn't need to do this. The open primary, last time I looked, we talked about the one-party dominance. It didn't just come after we put in a closed primary. We weren't doing too bad in the open primary either. So if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But that view did not prevail.
We do need to wrap it up. My apologies to those of you who did not get to ask your questions. Real quick here, I'd like each of you to look into the future. We'll limit this to one sentence each. Speculate wildly, please. Do you see Idaho's political dynamics changing in the next few years, next 20 years? If so, how? Betty, let's start with you.
Okay. Yes, I do. I'm hopeful that it will start changing in 2014. I do think that the current Republican Party and the current Republican Party platform is extreme. I think in a lot of ways you see similarities to 1988, a time when there was so much fringe activity in the majority party that the voters said, we're going to correct the ship. It's tilting too far to the right. I think we're seeing generational shifts on a lot of issues, and I think we're seeing geographic shifts. It's hard to say how much we'll move in 2014 or whether we'll be looking at 2024 or 2044. I hope it's not glacial. I suspect it won't be.
Was that one sentence with a lot of commas in it?
Yes, okay. It was. A lot of semicolons. Okay.
That was a William Faulkner sentence, I think.
Thank you. I like William Faulkner, Ben.
Stream of consciousness?
Yes.
Jim?
Oh, I'm next. It's my wish, I guess, that we would return to the emphasis of Cecil Andrus and focus on education, the economy, environmental protection. You talk about our reliance on the minimum wage. We had testimony early in this legislative session about, I think came from the director of the Department of Labor, where he said he was talking to employees or employers coming into the state not being able to find or match the skill set they needed for their companies. We have a serious problem with respect to workforce training, with respect to education. We need to start addressing those issues and get away from the fringe issues and social conservatism that we've wandered into against the advice of Phil Badd and other politicians.
But are things going to change?
Are they going to
change? Are we going to see Democrats make a comeback in Idaho, or is it going to be another 20 years of Republican domination?
Another 20 years of the Democrats in the wilderness, it could very well be. But I think the question right now in this one-party state, who is going to prevail within the Republican Party? Ben has talked about this and others, whether it's the far right or the right that is running the Republican Party, whether it's the establishment or the fringe. And now, in terms of the Central Committee, party organization, they're maintaining they are mainstream. I suspect there will be a correction now, and the establishment will prevail in this election. The Democrats, whether or not they can come back, I don't know. I annually predict the Chicago Cubs will win the World Series, so much of my prediction.
Well, another one sentence. He stole all my lines about what happened here. But I think there will be a change, but I think Jim hit it right on the head. There will be a change. I hope there will be a change shortly. There will be a change in the Republican Party first before you'll see it. Whether Democrats, I don't think we're going to see the Democrats in there breaking the dominance of the Republican Party. What I do see is a change in the Republican Party, I hope there is, in the Central Committee makeup, and get back, you know, not, you can be so far right, you're wrong. And I think everybody here would probably nod. And the fight, Lawrence Wasdom has characterized it, others have. There's some very key precinct committee fights in various counties across the state in the Republican primary that will tell. It may be a sea change that happens as early as the convention in Moscow in June. But the Republican Party, I think, will maybe trend back a little bit towards the middle because it's, in my opinion, we've gotten way out there. We need to still have the party of the big tent and let people have their, you know, make up their own minds on some things. But the that's more utopian, I think, than pragmatic.
Well, it's time to end our discussion, The Road to Red, How One Party Came to Dominate Idaho. A big thank you to our panel, Benny Sursa, Betty Richardson, Jim Weatherby. And for Boise State Public Radio, KBSX News 91.5, I'm Adam Cotterell. Thank you.